much for the invitation. I'm struck again at this meeting that we really don't talk to one another often enough. There are a lot of, I think, interesting elements that interplanetary studies of shocks, termination shock, can illuminate a number of the questions, I think, that have been posed and addressed here. And a number of the things that certainly space physicists have been thinking about in some detail, I think, would carry over quite profitably. One of these is the importance of the perpendicular diffusion coefficient, which from what I've seen in the presentations here, I'm not sure is fully appreciated. And the other thing is the temporal effect of particle acceleration. And so what I wanted to talk about is three things: particle acceleration at interplanetary shocks, and I'll spend most of my time on that. You don't have to worry too much about back reaction onto the plasma from energetic particles in this case. I was going to talk about the large-scale structure of the heliospheric termination shock, but I think Ed covered that in sufficient detail, and so this work that Vladimir Florinsky and I and a couple of others had done, I think I'm going to just skip past that, and I'll try and talk to Hans a little bit about the structure and dissipation at the termination shock in response to his question. So let me get started. I started out with 150 transparencies, and I've tried to whittle it down to about half of that, so I'm not sure I'm going to get through anything that I need to. But so what I wanted to talk about is this is just going to be a review. There's tremendous amount of detail. We've been working on this really since about 2000, and I've written a lot of papers on the subject. And I think we've reached a point where we can do very, very well with specific events. So I wanted to talk briefly about timescales and then just emphasize the importance of really unsteady, if you like, diffusive shock acceleration. And I'll initially focus on a quasi-parallel shock, and I'll look at both protons and heavy ions. And then I wanted to talk just very briefly about perpendicular shocks and then just model one specific event related to that. Just to remind you, there are really, in a very loose sense, two classes of events. There's the big gradual event that's associated with a CME that's driven off the sun, very big shock wave. We think that the shock accelerates particles. There are a number of significant differences between the impulsive event, where you have a flare going off and liberating a lot of particles through a mechanism we're not entirely sure about. And these tend to stream along. They're much more narrow events, if you like. They have different compositional character and so forth. And then you have intermediate things, which sort of combine both, and I'll try to mention some of that if I have time. So what are the timescales that we need to worry about in the interplanetary medium? Now remember, we have a shock that lifts off, or it's driven off by a CME close to the sun, so we're looking at you know, 10 solar radii where the shock may form, or it may form a little sooner than that, and then it's propagating into this inhomogeneous wind. The wind is pretty much at the same velocity, but the density is dropping off as r squared. And of course, the magnetic field is dropping off. It's initially radial, and then it drops off into an azimuthal type thing. So the decay is a 1 over r type of decay in the magnetic field strength. So the shock itself evolves significantly in propagating from the solar surface, or 5 or so solar radii, out to 1 astronomical units. And I'll show you in a minute that the geometry of the shock can change quite profoundly. That means you need to worry about the particle acceleration timescales relative to the dynamical timescale of the shock, which means that you have implications in terms of the maximum energy and also the shock obliquity. And then one has to worry very much about the variability and the nature of the generation of shock turbulence by the streaming instability, for example, and also by the in-situ turbulence in the solar wind. You also then have to worry about the particles escaping out of the shock, because they then have very long mean free paths, so you can use the diffusive approximation possibly in the location of the shock, but once you get beyond a certain distance, those particles no longer behave in the simple diffusive fashion, and you have to worry about solving the whole Boltzmann equation for their transport. So the problem is significantly complicated. So just an example, let me go on quickly, and I'll be referring to this particular event. It's sort of number 215. It's quite a nice example, and just to sort of reiterate a point that Joe Giacalone made yesterday, this particular event is interesting. There was a big shock prior to this event, and it kind of stirred up the interplanetary medium and as it propagated through, but it didn't accelerate particles in any significant sense. This event, which followed after, was a much weaker, less dramatic shock. and yet you saw a very nice particle acceleration. And so I'll sort of mention briefly why we think that happens. So the approach that we've taken is really the essence of simplicity, and in some sense had its precedent in an old paper that Heinz wrote, and it was sort of that sort of gave rise to the sort of onion shell terminology. Okay, so this is significantly updated on that. Life moves on and one gets a little cleverer in one's old age, I guess. But essentially what we do is we use in a mathematical sense, it's sort of a nice physically based operator split kind of approach. But essentially we solve the shock propagation problem numerically. We propagate a shock out into the interplanetary medium. And you can see here, for example, this is the shock speed, and you can see how it starts out at, you know, in this case, it's at about a half AU, and it's about 900 odd kilometers per second. You can see that it decelerates significantly as you go out to one astronomical unit. Shock compression ratio plays around a little, but it's a relatively weak shock. And essentially, if you just put this into a schematic, what you have is the leading shock, and then you've got the rarefaction attached to the shock in the simplest possible case. Of course, we do this numerically, so it's a lot more complicated. And essentially, then, you can sort of consider breaking all of these elements apart into shells, and you can then look at the individual components associated with the transport equation. You can look at adiabatic expansion in that shell. You can look at the convection in that shell. You can look at how the particles diffuse from one shell to another and into one another. So there's a nice, simple physical interpretation to all of this. And this just sort of illustrates, you know, how you can use a nice Green's function kind of approach and do this a little more sophisticatedly in a way than is typically done. I'm not going to go into those details. But I want you to sort of see, if you sit, suppose we have the spacecraft sitting over at that red point over there, which I'm shaking about. You'll notice that magnetic field line that's attached to the shock at various different times, you'll notice that as the shock propagates out, you're attached to the perpendicular part of the shock initially, and then by the time the shock arrives over there, it's pretty much a quasi-parallel. So you need to worry about the effects of the geometry changing as your shock propagates out, and you need to worry about the nature of the particle acceleration at the perpendicular region early on in this particular example, or at the parallel region later on in constructing then your intensity profile, your event integrated spectrum, and so forth. And you can sort of get some idea of time scales from that. So how do I calculate then the maximum energy associated with this? So as you recall, you know, Luke wrote this down rather nicely, and it's been played around with lots of people ever since. Essentially what you want to do is you want to look at the maximum particle energy by equating the dynamic time scale of the shock with the acceleration time scale, and you can do it in this sort of straightforward way. And that's complicated because you need to know the diffusion coefficient, and certainly in the case of the parallel diffusion coefficient, you all seen this, you can compute then the sort of coupled solution from the wave energy density equation, assuming some kind of driving, streaming instability, couple that into the diffusion coefficient. You can use a quasi-linear kind of approach to do that. And so the approach that we've taken is to basically use a sort of Marty Lee sort of calculation that he put together and compute all of that for the quasi-parallel shock. So when you do that, we find that the maximum energy looks like this slightly formidable expression. It's not really that too terribly bad. What you basically see is you see that the age of the shock enters into the maximum energy in this fashion over there. The strength enters in the same way. So this guy ages, maximum intensity, a maximum energy goes up, but of course the shock weakens, so that tends to offset that effect. And then you've got the magnetic field, which depends on heliocentric distance in this simple sense here for the Archimedean spiral. So you see then that it turns out, in fact, the maximum energy is closest to the sun because of that dominance of the spiral. And this little figure over here illustrates the maximum energy for different shock strengths. And you can see that the maximum energy to which you're capable of accelerating a particle falls off with increasing radial distance. And so the essential thing here that happens is you accelerate, in fact, up to GeV energies on occasion, close to the sun. Those particles can either be trapped or they're gradually released from the shock into the interplanetary medium and they propagate to your spacecraft sitting at one astronomical unit. You've got to worry about the turbulence at these shocks. So what happens? How do we treat it? For parallel shocks, basically we use the streaming instability. We amplify on shock transmission. That's That's a sort of by guess and by God game there. The shell picture is nice to describe the evolution of turbulence in the expanding field. In the simplest case, certainly close to the sun, it's okay to sort of assume a WKB description as the shell propagates outward. Okay, so now I've accelerated the particles at the shock. What do I do with them? Well, as I indicated, and I'll go into this in a little more detail, those particles escape. But then, of course, they then propagate into the interplanetary medium, and it's a very weakly scattering environment, weak scattering environment, so I need to solve the full Boltzmann equation. Do this in the context of a Monte Carlo type of model where, and I'm not really going to go into the details, there's basically a quasi-linear description placed on what that mean-free path should be. So what you have to do, and this was this technical question that I asked yesterday and was picked out by Heinz in the meeting for asking in the interval afterwards. But essentially, there's an interesting, complicated question as to how do you, in a sense, renormalize the problem when you go from a diffusive description in the box associated with your shells and your shock wave to this non-diffusive description outside. And so you have to kind of do a renormalization there to ensure that you don't foul up your fluxes and so forth. So one takes care of that, but it's a complicated problem. So here, for just looking at this, so near the shock, and this is so we calculate then the appropriate diffusion coefficient, or at least the turbulence power spectrum, and hence the diffusion coefficient in the vicinity of the shock. This is calculated as you propagate through with the appropriate thing. Here you can see an example. Wave intensity on the left, diffusion coefficient on the right is a function of heliocentric distance. And so your scattering properties are changing as the shock propagates out. And so you can then sit at one astronomical unit and then look at the upstream particle spectrum. This is now well before the shock. These are sort of, you know, this black line corresponds to, you know, less than 2 hours after the shock was initiated way back at the sun, and you can see that your very energetic particles have arrived. This is just different assumptions about the sort of normalizing mean free path. And you can see that the distribution that arrives, obviously most energetic particles arrive earliest. They have this kind of spectrum. You gradually begin to see this filling in. This is all well before the shock arrives. These are very early times. This is how it evolves at later and later times until you reach the shock. I'll show you more details. This is two examples for a strong and weak shock where you can see at different times, again, these are sort of times from black, you know, sort of to later times, to the eventual filled and event integrated spectrum. You can see that it doesn't have a nice simple power law kind of spectrum in that case, although in this particular weak shock case, you can fill out a spectrum quite nicely. You can look at intensity profiles. These are the kinds of things that are observed. I'll show you something more, a little more detail. One of the interesting little things that comes out of this, for example, is you release these particles from the shock as the shock propagates out. These particles stream out into interplanetary space, and they scatter all throughout the interplanetary medium. And sometimes these particles will be scattered back to you. You have to reabsorb them in the shock, or sometimes they're not. And if you're just sitting and happen to be counting these particles as they come past you at 1 AU prior to the arrival of the shock, some of these particles can even scatter as many as, or at least cross 1 AU as many as 15 times, at which point we kind of got tired of counting, but as many as 15 times before the shock arrives. So this makes the interpretation of an event-integrated spectrum at 1 AU quite complicated. This is just a little illustration to show how the anisotropy changes with energy and with time. You can see initially that everything is streaming outward, and then at later times, the most energetic particles are streaming back at you. And I think in this figure over here, sort of illustrates this case. This is just kind of the phase space evolution sitting at 1 AU, and this is basically V parallel plot. And so this out here, you see the most energetic particles arrive, and they're all streaming outward. This is well before the shock arrives. This is at 0.05 t. So 1 t is when the shock would arrive. So these are particles that have streamed out well before the shock arrives. You see the very fast energetic particles moving outwards, and you gradually start filling in as time progresses. So about sort of where the shock is halfway to you, you can see you've filled in both hemispheres quite nicely. And then you'll notice that the energetic particles are starting to come back at you from way beyond one astronomical unit. The shock's no longer accelerating those particles, and the only energetic particles that you still happen to see happen to be particles that were released way earlier, streamed out well beyond 1 AU, scattered and came back. So that was protons. Heavy ions. Heavy ions we can treat as in a sense, as more or less test particles. Here we no longer calculate the... I should have mentioned, but essentially what we do with the protons is we use the protons to generate the wave field. The heavy ions are number densities are so low that you really don't need to worry about their streaming and stability associated with that. So they're essentially seeing the resonant or seeing the waves that were generated by the protons. And so then the gyro frequency that these guys resonate with is now modified by the Q over A ratio. Mean free path changes, the resonance condition changes. That means that the maximum energy condition changes because they can resonate only with the particle, with the energetic waves that are produced. That means that the protons tend to produce the highest energies, CNO, the next, and then ion, the next highest energies, and that's kind of illustrated in this little plot over here, which is the corresponding evolution of maximum energy. And so if we go now to sort of look at putting all of this together, the protons, the ion, the oxygen, this is just an example of how the ion spectrum unfolds over time. You can see most energetic particles form. These are observations up here, time event integrated spectra. You can see how this set of simulations basically unfolds. And if you then look at protons, oxygen, ion, you can see that event integrated spectra for all three species do an absolutely remarkable job. The red is obviously the model, and you've got a combination of ulysses and cis observations, and you can fit all three, and there are very few parameters in that event. So this is sort of one of my pride and joy type of figures. Okay, some other comments. Ion to oxygen ratios can be sort of understood in terms of this change and the behavior of the maximum energies. You can see how the three event integrated spectra look different at different energies. You can look at time intensity profiles. You can see, for example, that the 53 MeV particles were accelerated early close to the sun, and then they were no longer accelerated, and they've basically dribbling out of the shock as the shock propagates. They were trapped behind, and they dribble out, and you can see that it's gradually decaying intensity profile. You can see that the 10 MeV protons were accelerated for a while and then no longer, and so on for the different energies. You can look at iron and oxygen, and you can notice that, for example, the iron in the green, I forget what that was, 50, that's right in front of me, 57 MeV per nuke. You can see that at some point they were no longer being accelerated, so their intensity profile drops off, unlike that of the oxygen. So you can anticipate then iron to oxygen ratios that change as a result of that. I don't know how much time I have, but I've got far too much to do. Okay, perpendicular shocks. Problem here is there's no self-excited waves, but we need to worry about that. And so in this case, the scattering is going to be done no longer by self-excited turbulence, but by the in-situ turbulence. And so you need a model to understand what the solar wind turbulence looks like. If it's slab turbulence only, that is just essentially Alphane waves. There's no random walking of the Alphane waves. I can explain that later. If you in fact look at a superposition of 2D and slab turbulence, which is the sort of model that's emerged from both theory, simulations, and observations, it turns out that the introduction of this transverse 2D component leads to something that's essentially like passive scalar mixing. And so flux tubes or magnetic field lines tend to wander significantly under those circumstances. You can put together a fairly nice analytic theory. It's a nonlinear theory for the perpendicular diffusion coefficient. And you can then compute the perpendicular diffusion coefficient under the assumption that you've got this kind of superposition model of 2D and slab. You can do a sort of elaborate calculation, get an estimate of it. The important point, however, is now you're no longer working with the resonance condition. You've got a mean free path parallel to the magnetic field, which you assume the particles are diffusive along, but the basic physics of the perpendicular diffusion is dictated by the way the magnetic field random walks. And so this magnetic field random walks across the shock. You've got a particle that can fly very rapidly along that magnetic field, cross over in principle multiple times, but now the essence of the problem is now the diffusion of the magnetic field rather than the resonance condition. And so when you take a look, for example, and this is, God knows how I'm going to explain this in 2 minutes, but if you take a look at this, this is supposed to be the mean free path for the solid line is the parallel mean free path, and this dashed line is the perpendicular mean free path. And you can see that roughly the perpendicular mean free path is about a hundredth of the mean free path in the parallel direction. Very small mean free path. If you plot this in a different way, where you look at the mean free path as a function of the gyro radius, what this plot over here shows is essentially the mean free path that normalizes the correlation length. Is this dashed line is essentially the Bohm limit as a function of the mean free path. This is the Bohm limit, and you see this is the perpendicular diffusion coefficient. The perpendicular diffusion coefficient with random line magnetic field walking can become significantly small. Anyway, you tie all of that stuff in. I'm not going to go through the injection, but what you find is that for the maximum energy, for the particle acceleration, for heavy ions and for at a quasi-parallel shock, both the heavy ions and the proton maximum energy is determined by the resonance condition. So it's determined by the nature of the spectrum, and you can get a QR over A squared dependence on the maximum energy for heavy ions. That is no longer the case. Now it depends on the properties of the turbulence when you get to perpendicular shocks. And so you can then get a different maximum energy. And then you can go in and extract observational signatures that are related to the spectral breakpoint, that point that Joe was showing. And it turns out that you can distinguish very nicely between quasi-parallel and highly perpendicular shocks on the basis of that. So you tend to see this. John, I know you were supposed to be showing me this little picture of how much time I've got. I have time then, okay. Fair enough. okay. Well, it's probably been sort of 80% incomprehensible, but I've still got 10 minutes to go. So before I sort of leave this, I wanted to sort of just very briefly just illustrate at least one interesting observation that's associated with perpendicular shocks and quasi-perpendicular shocks. And if you take a look at an interplanetary shock and look at the magnetic field data over here, and you look at selected intervals ahead of the shock and ask what is the wave power activity associated with those activities. And this shock was selected because, in fact, it was a clear particle accelerator. There was a signature of what seemed to be diffusive shock acceleration. But when you looked at the wave power ahead of the shock at these selected intervals, basically, you saw no difference from way up, almost way up, and right in front of the shock. Nothing whatsoever. Whereas if you had a look at an oblique shock, which was also a nice example of a particle accelerator, and you again looked at the same sort of intervals, blue, green, and red, you notice that there's an increase in the wave power as you approach that. That shock's accelerating particles, and so is that shock. On this case, it's presumably due to the excitation of the streaming instability ahead and the scattering of the particles ahead of the shock. In this case, it's purely due to the random walking of the magnetic field ahead of the shock. Oh, goodness. I'm not sure whether it was ACE or WIND, but one of those. I think so, yeah. I think because Chung Hu did this data analysis, and we were using one of those data sets, I think. Over there. Yeah, I think so. There's the RMS. Yeah. All right, so I can run through this. Hopefully, I sort of talked about this basic sort of theoretical model for highly perpendicular shock acceleration, which is essentially relying on in-situ turbulence on the random walk of the magnetic field, which then leads to a diffusion coefficient, a perpendicular diffusion coefficient that's significantly different. I didn't talk about that. I don't think I want to. I mentioned this thing. There's a considerable amount of work that's been done on this now by a number of groups, and I think the perpendicular diffusion coefficient has probably been reasonably well pinned down, at least for the heliospheric problems. And then, okay, didn't talk too much about that and that. Okay. So let me just give one last example here of something. Particle acceleration in these mixed events, as I indicated, it seems that when you look at the abundances of solar energetic particle events, that sometimes you can have abundances that look like a mixture of impulsive, so it's enriched in helium-3, for example, and it also has characteristics of a gradual event. And so some time back, we sort of looked at this theoretically, where we sort of looked at the possibility that you had a flare only and you'd see this kind of intensity profile associated with a flare. If you had just a CME that went off and no associated sort of seeding of the interplanetary medium by energetic particles by a preceding flare, then you would just have a CME and you'd have this more gradual event, gradual growth, and then these plateaus versus this decay. And then you could have the mixed event where you had a flare go off and then followed by a CME, and you could have something that's sort of intermediate between the two and mixed. And so observationally, this is seen now very frequently. So we sort of had a look at one particular model where we played with some observations using ACE, stereos, GOES, and SAMPEX data. Excuse me. And I'm just showing the results here. Red again is the models. These are the various collection of the various data points. And on the left, this is for protons. Okay, I thought I had. Okay, and it turns out that in order to accommodate this, and I'll show it more clearly in the next transparency, in order to accommodate this high energy tail, basically we had to have an admixture of about 25% of flare particles in that event. And on the left here, this is for the ion. This is the ion spectrum. You can see that in the absence of flare particles, there's absolutely no way we can model that high energy part of the tail. But if you take again this 25% ratio that we use for the protons, you find that you can in fact quite nicely match those spectrofilaments. Okay, and the same goes for the oxygen here. All right. So basically, the free parameters in these kinds of models is this escape length ahead of the shock, which I didn't talk about, but there's this question of renormalizing that I mentioned briefly, and then the mean free path scaling. These are not terribly important parameters in a way, and then we played around with the flare parameters, obviously. All right, so Ed spoke about this, so I'm not going to run through it. This was just some, as I said, very nice little calculation that Vladimir Florinsky did. It relied, I should add, on this model, this approach that I showed you to the perpendicular mean free path and the sort of calculated mean free path, and one that was inferred from the mean free path that was needed to match those observations for the just ahead of the termination shock, agreed pretty well. And there's that figure that Ed showed. So I just wanted to finish off very briefly, and again here I've just run through this in an extremely abbreviated way, just to remind you there were three crossings of the termination shock, and Ed showed this, and you can see there's nothing terribly exciting happening to the magnetic field ahead of this particular shock, which I'm going to look at most closely. This was the so-called TS3 event. There were five crossings of the termination shock by Voyager 2. Voyager 2 was important because it had a working plasma instrument, unlike Voyager 1. So you can see here that there were five crossings. Two of those crossings occurred during data gaps. But this came out very, very beautifully. This is a sort of almost textbook example of a perpendicular shock, and this is this TS3 event over here. And you can see that there's a nice foot formed, and then you can see that there's a very clear ramp, and then you've got the overshoot and undershoot downstream of the shock. Now, this is the microstructure of the shock. The magnetic field and data was 48 second intervals. And you can see that the structure comes out very, very cleanly, to the extent that you can blow up this region over here. You can see the foot, and then you can see microscale structure inside the ramp itself, these pretty high frequency oscillations, and then you go through and onto there. So on the basis of this, the TS3 event would appear to be a supercritical quasi-perpendicular shock. It's got all the classical features right down to the internal structure. But the curiosity about this shock is this temperature plot that was produced by the plasma data by the plasma instrument. And that is that the termination, just ahead of the termination shock, the plasma temperature was on the order of about 20,000 degrees Kelvin, not very hot at all. And then downstream, the temperature was measured to be about 180,000 degrees, which at first glance sounds rather high, but if you recall from Ed's opening or second transparency, he was pointing out that all the models that we do for the large-scale structure suggest that the temperature downstream of the termination shock should be sometimes 10 to the 6K. And that just falls out of the Rankine-Hugonier jump conditions. It's just basic conservation of energy, and there's nothing you can do about it. So why on earth you should be seeing 180,000 degrees downstream of the termination shock was, I guess, a surprise to a lot of people. If you look at the plasma, okay, a minute left. If you look at the plasma data downstream, you can see that the distribution just looks like a sort of shifted, slightly flat top Maxwellian. There's no evidence of reflected ions in the thermal solar wind temperatures. Okay, basically, when John Richardson looked at this data and then converted it into magnetosonic Mach numbers, it was clear that the shock looked like a supersonic transition. This wasn't a surprise to everyone, and in fact, here's the plot showing the Mach number being greater than 1 downstream on the basis of those observations. This wasn't actually a surprise to everyone. In fact, in 1996, we'd looked very closely at what a pickup ion distribution would do when it interacts with a perpendicular shock. We'd in fact predicted there that most of the dissipation would be done by the pickup ions. And unfortunately, the plasma instrument on Voyager 2 wasn't instrumented to measure pickup ions, which gives theorists a great deal of wiggle room, which is always a good thing. But you can take a look at this. This is the Maxwellian distribution just ahead of the termination shock, just plotted in phase space like that, 20,000 degrees Kelvin. And this is plotted in the frame of the solar wind, in the frame of the termination shock. And you can see that it's just basically a cold beam that's incident on the shock. This is the filled shell pickup ion distribution. And you can see that it, because it's picked up in the supersonic solar wind, basically has particles in the shock frame that either are moving very, very slowly relative to the shock, in the direction of the shock normal, almost no velocity at all, or twice the solar wind speed. And so, I don't know if I've got a figure in here, but essentially what happens at a perpendicular shock is you've got a cross-shock potential which is capable of reflecting ions. These ions over here move very, very slowly, so they're reflected preferentially. They're really very, very little in the way of superthermal, in the way of solar wind ions that are moving sufficiently slowly that they will be reflected. So primarily, pickup ions are reflected at the termination shock. And sometimes undergo multiple reflections at that cross-shock potential, sometimes as many as 10, 12 times, but most of them undergo just a single reflection. About 14 to 16%, that means about 3 to 5% of the incoming ions are reflected. You can put together a rather nice model for all of this. You can do all the appropriate calculations. You can put the numbers in. And what you can find then is that upstream, the pickup ion temperature is on the order of 10 to the 6K. That's the and the solar wind temperature downstream turns out to be 180,000 K or so, based on the shock compression ratio. And the downstream, the transmitted pickup ion population, the reflected pickup ion population, basically carry all the energy. The transmitted ions are nearly 10 to the 7 K, the reflected ions, you can estimate what their energy should be based on some of the scales that you see. They should be well up in it, you know, 7 times 10 to the 7 K. And so most of the energy is going then into the reflected and transmitted pickup ions at the termination shock. And you can use that to construct a synthetic spectrum where this is the downstream proton spectrum, a thermal Maxwellian, very cold, 180,000, and then superimposed on that is a transmitted and a reflected pickup ion distribution. And you can use that then, as Ed was indicating, in models to try to understand the energetic neutral atoms that are likely to be observed by the IBEX mission. And we already see that certainly based on kappa distributions that one can do a reasonably good job. So I'm going to just close off there and leave you with that interesting, unusual termination shock with characteristics that are unlike anything else I think that's seen in the solar system, certainly. So thanks.
I guess more point of clarification. It was said that the Mach number of the termination shock was 4. That really seems to be a Mach number with respect to the pickup ion contribution.
That's correct, yeah.
If we take the thermal part, the Mach number is closer to 20. The background thermal part, the Mach number is closer to 20.
Yeah, in fact, if you look at the magnetosonic numbers, it'll be closer to 10 just because it's dominated by the Alphane Mach number, which is on the order of about 10.
Okay.
So in the absence of pickup ions, the magnetosonic Mach number of the shock is about 10-ish. And in the presence of pickup ions, it drops to about 4. And it's a combination of factors. The one is you've got the thermal solar wind augmented by the pickup ion pressure. And the other thing is that the pickup process itself has decelerated the large-scale solar wind flow by about 30%. So it's a combination of those two factors that reduces the Mach number and hence the strength of the shock.
Sure, but if you just focus on the thermal distribution, ignoring the magnetic and pickup contribution, there still is some gain in entropy in that gas as it flows out from the inner solar system to 100 AU or whatever. It hasn't fallen off as R to the minus...
Well, the density is falling off as R to the minus 2. And if you just look at the sonic Mach number, if you ignore that, the sonic Mach number, I think, if I remember correctly, and this is probably about 8 years ago now, 10 years ago, is can be on the order of about 50, 60.
I mean, it's saying,
a massive...
I was thinking about 30 before, based on what you said. But,
yeah.
But still, I think it gains energy. I'm just curious about the end, how that gas changes its entropy as it moves outwards.
Well, it's just through pickup ions. It's just through the addition of pickup ions.
So that's the dominant mode of heating of that gas.
Oh, yeah, so it's completely dominated by...
No, well, I'm saying the pickups are different. I'm regarding that as a different contribution.
Well, okay, I can tell you a lot more about this, probably more than you ever want to know, but you've got the pickup ions. They're sort of at least the solar wind, the interstellar hydrogen is being picked up from about 8 AU outwards beyond the ionization cavity. So you're adding pickup ions. The pickup ions themselves, to see the motional electric field, they end up getting about a kV in energy. Mm-hmm. So they form this big, initially ring beam distribution. The ring beam then excites alphanic fluctuations, which scatter them onto the pickup ions onto a bispherical distribution, which is co-moving with the solar wind. There's not enough equilibration time for them to really thermally equilibrate with the solar wind ions, so they form this filled shell. Those pickup ions, however, in generating that turbulence, are also dissipating, and that dissipation is, we think, seen in the solar wind, because when you look at the solar wind temperature profile at about 20 astronomical units, the temperature begins to actually start increasing. And that increase can be tied very nicely into basically dissipating about 10% of the wave energy density generated by the pickup ions and heating the solar wind. So it hangs together really nicely. We've written a number of papers. This is sort of work that Bill Matthews and I did, and where we put together the sort of turbulence evolution model. And you can pretty much explain from one astronomical unit out to 70, 80 astronomical units, the observed wave energy or the turbulence energy density, and the temperature profile with very little fitting of parameters. It's a very nice model.
Yeah. Gary, would it be fair to say that if you neglect flare-accelerated particles, basically what you've shown is that when you allow for all these local complications, all particle acceleration in the heliosphere is described by diffusive shock acceleration?
I think it would be fair to say. I would say that the complications are associated with just what particles you inject.
Yeah, but this is an important point, because if I go back 20 years, there were people who disputed this.
I think the dispute, and for example, one of the figures that Joe showed, the Van Ness figure, I think the essential thing is people looked at particle acceleration observers. I'm not knocking observers. I'm about to knock observers, okay. Sorry. No. I think, you know, in their defense, we haven't really... I mean, to some extent, the idea of diffusive shock acceleration has been based on steady-state models, planar steady-state, and it works very nicely. You expect a power law distribution. You expect these nice exponential rises at the shock and so forth. And so when observers looked at the SEP populations, they didn't see that stuff. They saw these very complicated power laws, and really it's the result of complicated transport processes. It's the result of the shock being very variable as it propagates. It's, you know, all the things that I described there.
I wonder what is the contribution of the co-rotating interaction regions to your gas heating. I always thought this is a major contributor.
It is, and I guess you know, we include that when we look, for example, at I didn't show any of you. I mean, that's another talk altogether, but when we were looking at the shock turbulence transport model and the associated heating model, we do include things like stream shear, shocks that propagate through, and so forth. And so I think one of the principal results that came out of that very extensive study is that we can understand why the wave power, the energy in fluctuations, decays in a WKB-like way all the way out to 8 AU. We haven't put in pickup ions because, well, pickup ions really come in at that point. And it really has nothing to do with WKB theory. It's basically the balance between dissipation and these various source terms that happens to ensure that you balance the dissipation rate with the driving rate. And in some sense, it's not really a surprise. I mean, that's the essence of a Kolmogorov type of distribution. As much energy as you pump in at the large scales, you're going to pull out of them, and it just fits itself together. So yeah, it's an important contributor, and that's why you have non-adiabatic temperature profile with an 8 AU.
You've nicely demonstrated that protons can be accelerated in both parallel and perpendicular environments. What about electrons?
I'll just throw my hands up with electrons. Maybe completely unfair of me, but I'm not sure any of us really understands how to accelerate electrons. I mean, you can get them up to, once you get them up to super high, and you know, reasonably high energies, and they're resonant with the waves that are already created, life's fine and well. But I have no idea how to go from my regular old electron to something that's actually going to radiate and be observed by everybody else.
But is it fair to say that observationally there are not a lot of cases where electrons are accelerated?
No, you know, the trouble is, as we'd briefly spoken about, you don't tend to see electron acceleration occurring very often at interplanetary shocks, and the electrons tend to behave adiabatically at the shocks. So it's just difficult to see how you get these electrons sufficiently energetic, at least at interplanetary shocks.
Parallel shocks, it's hard because you don't have, it's got to be resonant scattering, but if it's a perpendicular shock, they can follow the meandering field lines.
Yeah.
And the termination shock, clearly there was a big enhancement of electrons.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. That little figure that I showed you, when I drew that originally many years ago, I was thinking primarily of protons, but I think, as Joe's pointed out, energetic electrons could very easily be accelerated in that same manner.
All right.